Hello. Moi. Let's just take a few minutes to just meditate in silence together for a few minutes. And then I'll share some reflections. So, please do let me know if the sound doesn't work at any moment or if it gets like intermittent. We have incessant rain here. It's been raining for days, and today it's raining, and there's wind and that. So sometimes in those conditions, the Zoom sound gets funny. So please let me know. And then if the sound isn't good, we can turn off the cameras. And sometimes that makes it better if the sound isn't good. And also if you feel better like that. So sometimes coming to retreat, we can start with an intention of doing it one way, and then realize after 24 hours that that's not quite right. And that's a really alive meditation when you realize that you don't have to stick to a plan, you know? You don't have to stick to a fixed idea about how you had intended things to be, because even after 24 hours, sometimes you can realize that you need something else. You need something to be a little bit different. And maybe just sitting in silence for 16 hours a day is not not quite right for this retreat. Or you realize that that's what you do want, is to just sit, not even get up to go to the toilet, just 24 hours a day, whatever. So there's a real, it's a real elasticity practice to listen to what's happening, especially in this, these conditions where we're all together here, but at the same time, we're not in a meditation hall. You're not stuck in some place, physically, geographically. And this, as difficult as it is to do online retreats and stuff, it has this advantage, this benefit that you can adapt to what you need a little bit along the way. And so I'd really invite you to listen carefully to how is it going. And if it feels right to you, to set an intention for this retreat, to set to do that, set an intention for this retreat. You know, I'm going to do more sitting, or for this retreat, I'm going to do more walking, or I'm going to really mix, or I'm not going to drink coffee, or I am going to, or whatever, whatever your determination, your area of exploration is going to be. To go, okay, this is maybe what I'm into. And then to listen, like, the image that comes to my mind is, you know, what fishes have there for breathing, you know, the gills, these very delicate things that fish breathe with on their backs, the fish lungs, you know, to listen in that way, very delicate listening. Is this right? Is this right? And this is meditation. That kind of listening is meditation, where we're not fixing things in a box and staying with a concept. We're going beyond, much bigger than a concept. And we're letting, say a concept was a big glass jar, it's just letting it break and coming out of a concept. And the advantage always of a retreat, whether we're in a physical place together or online, is that we don't need to be anyone. We don't need to show, you know, it doesn't mean that we're not participating and talking and dialoguing a bit in the talks and stuff, where in the times for questions and that. But we don't need to put on any presentation of being anything, of being a fantastic meditator who's nearly enlightened, or a cool and sexy person, or a fashionable person, or a whatever person. We can just actually, it's like a holiday, you know. And in that sense, it's a holiday from the being a persona, being a putting that energy into being someone and saying to the world, look who I am, look who I am, look, this is me, this is me. And I have this childhood, and I have this, and you know, we can actually just go. And it doesn't mean that we disappear and that we're no one and that we don't exist. It just means that the energy of persona is not necessary for us to be together, doing this work together, this amazing work together. We don't need to. And so I know also that on online retreats, we may feel more isolated, or even on silent retreats, for people who are just beginning silent retreats, it can feel more, whoa, this is a big deal. This is a big challenge to be in silence. And we're really here for each other. And Sumedha and I are here to help along with that, so that if there's something really, you know, really strong happening, please get in touch, you know, and we'll talk it through. But also just the perception, the way that we're feeling it. We're so used to that thing of social links being what make us somehow someone, and that being alone and in silence suddenly, who am I, you know? Am I alone? Do I belong? Am I loved? You know, all these questions can come up. And just this other way of being together, where we're just sitting together in silence, and we all belong. We're all in it. We're all in this world in that way. And that's some magic with meditation that I really love. Anyways, that was just a little bit about retreat. And just sometimes when there's, if there's some difficulty, sometimes just to remember this gift of sitting back from social life, sitting and resting in silence with the web of us together here, holding for each other. We're caught in a lovely web of people who've all given themselves this gift of, let's have some retreat time. Let's be alone together in a way. And the joy that can be, can give. I wanted to share a little bit about attitudes, also to meditation, to spirituality. I love talking about this. And also I was speaking of like this jar of concepts that can shatter, can break away. How often we come to meditation and retreat and we've had one type of experience. And as someone was speaking about this morning in the group, then there's that wish to get that experience again. So we get a pleasant, a nice experience, and then we want that again. And it's not that that's bad or anything. It's just the noticing it, that that's happening. This is meditation too. This is part of meditation practice. That suppleness that goes, I've gone there. My mind has gone, I want this. So everything that's happening to us in our daily life, the constant push and pull of I want the good stuff and I don't want the disagreeable stuff. Often that happens in meditation. It's just that sitting in meditation or lying down or walking is a big cooking pot to be able to see the ingredients in the soup a bit better that we don't usually see in our daily lives. And certainly the ideas of meditation can often be very different from what's actually happening. And so often after 2-3 days of meditation on retreats, people say, but I can't stop thinking. I can't stop thinking, or I'm having all this anger or aversion and things like this. And it's like something is wrong. This is just no good. I often get the feeling of people thinking that they're not good at meditation. That's not what's happening really. It's that the expectation was an idea about meditation. We had a concept that meditation, as is sold to us, when we see images of people doing yoga, sitting like this, and normally in the photos, they're the glamorous people, the really good looking ones who've got a suntan and they've got the right lycra clothes on and they look so calm and zen and perfect, you know, and they haven't had any difficulties in their life. You can tell straight away they've had a perfect life and it's all very easy. And, you know, and it's even more perfect because they do meditation and yoga and stuff. So it's almost like we're sold an idea of enlightenment. And then we come on retreat and then the reality of what's happening doesn't fit the idea. And then there's a bit of a fight. Hey, there's a bit of a struggle about, but I meditate, so I should be calm. You know, I should be this and I should be this and I should be this and I should be doing this like this. And, but what's happening? What's actually happening is something else. And meditation is what's actually happening. So it's not the idea of what should be happening. But that's really, it's really helpful to remember that. What are my expectations? What are my ideas of how meditation should be? And where's the Grand Canyon? And can we slowly, during a retreat, make that Grand Canyon between the idea and what's actually happening? It will slowly get smaller and then there'll be unity. And it might be a moment of messy enlightenment. And there might be tears. And that's still enlightenment, just even for 20 seconds, you know? So I want to read a poem now from a priest, a Jesuit priest. And please tell me if I'm speaking too fast, because I know that you're not born speaking English. So it's a different, and sometimes I might get excited and then I forget that you're not born speaking English, you know? So I keep trying to keep the language, not too much slang, but I know most Finnish people are pretty good at English, but still sometimes I get excited, you know? So you just have to go noon. Calm down. So this is a poem by Paddy Otuoma. Maybe I've read it before on another retreat, I don't know. So every morning I sit, I kneel, waiting, making friends with the habit of listening, hoping that I'm being listened to. I say hello to my chaos, my unmade decisions, my unmade bed, my desire and my trouble. I recognize and greet my burdens, my luck, my controlled and uncontrollable stories, my unfolding story, my unloved body, my own love, my own body. I greet the things I think will happen, and I say hello to everything I do not know about the day. I greet my own small world, and I hope that I can meet the bigger world that day. I greet my story during the day, and hope that I can forget my story during the day. That I can hear some stories and greet some surprising stories during the long day ahead. I greet God, and I greet the God who is more God than the God I greet. Hello to you all, I say, as the sun rises above the chimneys of northern Belfast. Hello. If you feel like I could read it again at the end of this. Yeah? Okay. So this is what we were doing this morning, I think it was, and a little bit yesterday evening was this practice of in Buddhist technical terms, it's the first three factors of enlightenment. There are seven factors of enlightenment that are in us naturally, in our mind, in our heart mind naturally. And the first three, we can really practice with a lot. And then the other ones just come on their own, normally. And sometimes it happens the other way around, of course. But what I was speaking of last night and this morning was just a broad awareness. So sitting ourselves down into our broad awareness and keep being with that. Often through anchoring in the body, in whichever way, because there's so many different ways to be grounded in the body. So many different ways. And Sumedha and I will offer many different ways throughout this retreat. So there's that basic grounding, broad awareness. And the second one is curiosity, inquiry. So that's that question. What's happening now? What's happening now? And then we get distracted and something happens and we come back to what's happening now? Oh, what's this? Like curiosity. And then a little bit like fine-tuning all the time our effort, which is, I know, such a big subject for so many of us meditators, how much effort we're putting in. I think most of the time it's because we come from a society, Western society, of drivenness, of needing to achieve, to get there, you know. So being aware of our of what effort we're, how much we're trying, you know, are we trying too hard or too little? Being aware of that can be really helpful. And so there's that fine tuning. In the old days, in the older days, or you could say, cars used to have a carburetor, you know. Nowadays, people hardly know what a carburetor is, but it's like it's a chamber where there's petrol coming in and air. And when your car isn't working properly, if you have an old-fashioned car, you used to be able to just get a screwdriver, and there was a screw that you could you could regulate the two so that they were at the right levels. So if you have too much air, the car doesn't work. And if you have too much petrol, it doesn't work either. So you need to regulate it. And I think, and it was just a little screw down in most engines that most people knew how to find. You could do it with a penknife or with a fork almost, you know. And often I feel like it's like that for our, the amount of effort we're putting into meditation, you know. I don't know if you could say that the awareness is the air and the inquiry is the petrol. Maybe you could. I know it's not very kind of spiritual sounding as a metaphor, but voila, it works for me. I don't know if it works for you, but it's just feeling into that. Because so often we come, as we were also speaking about this morning in the group, we often come to meditation with our worldly habits, with our worldly conditioning, and then we just transpose it into meditation, hey? And I think most people, if you look out for that, you will find there's something in the way you meditate that has the character of how you relate in life. So often, Sometimes it takes a few years of meditation to find that. And that's okay. It's normal. There's nothing wrong. It's just, there's that going on, that same energy. Like that same drivenness. And so most of the time it's sitting back a bit more. We need to sit back a bit more and not try so hard. And then every now and again, there's a few people that are like, just everything, let it go. Like, and those, sometimes those people, they need to gather in a bit more and, you know, and be a little firmer in their effort and bring a little bit more effort, not be so kind of mushroomy, kind of marshmallowy, you know. But most people, it's the other way around, isn't it? So those are these three, that big wide awareness, that curiosity about what's happening now, and that tuning of our effort. And actually, we could spend our whole life just doing that, even outside of meditation times, sitting meditation or lying down or walking meditation, our whole life, it would be sufficient for good practice to just do those three all day, every day, wherever we are. Awareness, walking down the street, on the train, at the job, on the computer, whatever, family dinner, doing the washing up, awareness. And then what's happening now? Our whole life. What's happening now? What's happening now? Okay. Is it wholesome to dwell in this? Yes. Or whatever. So our mindfulness is choosing. It's like the weather vane, choosing. And that choosing as well with the effort. There's a spiritual guide called Adyashanti, maybe some of you know. And someone asked him a question like, but how do you keep enlightened? You know, if you're enlightened, how do you just get enlightened and then it just stays like a kind of fixed thing, you know? Is it like some shelf you get to and then you can sit on that shelf or what? I can't remember how the question was. But his answer was really interesting because he said, enlightenment is the same as as with awareness. We could just constantly be choosing awareness or not. We can all the time be making that conscious choice. I can come back to presence now. And then there's the attitude to how we come back to that presence. And this, there's a teacher also that someone mentioned this morning, Utejanai, who often comes to teach for Nirodha, I think, that I would love to sit with. But I've never read his books. I just, I read one phrase by him and it changed my life forever. It changed my meditation practice forever. And it was with what attitude are you meditating? To be aware of your attitude to yourself, to your meditation practice. Because so often we can be quite hard with ourselves in meditation. And just that gently coming back attitude can be so good, can be so helpful. And the more almost like, say we're meditating and we fall off, and say we grab ourselves and pull ourselves back on. Whoop, come on, get back on, onto the tightrope, onto the seat of meditation. This jerking ourselves back on, it doesn't help us to have a supple heart. It doesn't go towards that. But the practice over and over and over again of gently bringing ourselves back with kindness, this helps our heart to grow supple, more and more elastic heart, supple. Not elastic in a way that other people could walk on us, that we have no firmness, that we can't say no to people, but a suppleness around life that's not brittle. You know, brittle being something that's easy to break, that's hard and easy to break at the same time. But supple, something more, you know, like Robson, you know, Robson? It's this kind of rubber paint that you put on roofs. So it can move, but it protects. This kind of suppleness. So really, really being able, I invite you on this retreat to really taste that feeling of growing that muscle, that heart muscle of suppleness, that is not hard, that is not, hey, come on, hop, you know, like this, that is not, come on, you didn't do good today, like that, but that is so gentle. Once again, we come back to meditation. Once again, we come back to centeredness. And I think I would like to correct myself there. I don't mean come back to meditation, but actually the coming back is meditation. The falling off is meditation, and the coming back. And that learning to be gentle is meditation. And the getting it wrong is meditation too. And feeling what it's like to get it wrong. Feeling what it's like to fall off and feel the... what happens when we go off into judgmental attitudes to ourselves? How does it feel in our body? You know, this is meditation. All of our falling off and errors, and the journey back to presence is the meditation practice. It's not the perfection. The perfection is something else, some idea, but it's the journey of that. Am I making sense so far? Yeah? Please say if there's some area I'm not really making sense in. Please just unmute yourself and tell me, ask me your questions, or say, hey, what are you talking about? Or whatever. I love this story from the Ajahn Chah tradition. Ajahn Chah was a very famous monk in Thailand whose tradition Sumedha and I have been very influenced by. And he brought the practice of Buddhism back to basics, because it had gone a bit off it had gone into something a bit, a lot of superstition and kind of rituals against ghosts. And it had got quite urbanized and I think monetized, you know. So the monks were fat and rich and and this kind of thing. And or the monks were very overly ascetic, you know, like they'd gone off on a trip about being the solitary monk in the forest meditating alone. And so they'd gone that either one extreme or the other, between asceticism and indulgence and getting fat, you know, with the people offering all the time riches, silk robes and stuff. And Ajahn Chah, he created a lot of monasteries because his attitude to practice was that it's when we're in community that the practice really becomes real with other people. Under a tree on your own, you can imagine that you're enlightened very quickly because you don't have to argue about who's doing the washing up, you know, whose turn it is to take the dustbin out and these basic everyday life stuff, you know. And so Ajahn Chah created like 300 monasteries or something in his life. And a lot of the time the practice was very collective based, you know, like we're all going to build some roads and mix cement. And so the monks couldn't just float up and become disconnected. They were doing some physical work and helping out the local farmers, making roads and things like this. And then suddenly, okay, let's meditate now for a few months, you know. So people couldn't get too stuck in, oh, I just want things to be like this, because suddenly it would change, you know, and people would need to adapt. And so this helped to create this supple heart. So I love that. I love that about that tradition, that it's very basic, very forest, but it's not extreme, just me alone getting enlightened in my mind. It's about us doing it together through the difficulties we have with each other. So I really love that about that tradition. But the story I wanted to tell you was so Ajahn Chah, this is a story I've heard from other people, and it's a bit like that. In the Ajahn Chah tradition, lots of people tell stories and then they get passed on, you know. And maybe we all tell them in different ways, the stories. But he's walking in the jungle with some young monks. And in the jungle, there's a big stone, you know, big stone. And he says, you see that rock there? And the monks say, yes, Bhante, we see the rock. And he says, do you think that rock's heavy? And they say, yes, that's a really heavy rock. And Ajahn Chah says, it's only heavy if you try to pick it up. So this is pointing to the same thing in our spiritual practice, you know, that we don't have to try to pick every heavy rock up on our own. And that it depends on our attitude, you know. What something is, it doesn't have to be heavy. Something doesn't have to be a big load, as if we're carrying the weight of the world on our shoulders and it's all my problem, or all of the problem is me. You know, in any issue, in any difficulty, we can quite quickly go into these attitudes as it's because of me, because I'm not good enough, because da di da di da. And we're picking it up in a heavy way that we don't need to. And sometimes just that reminder of, well, we don't need to pick stuff up in that kind of way. Things are independence on our relationship to them, you know? The rock can just be a beautiful rock and you can go and sit on it if you want. You could walk by it and leave it alone as well. Or you could just go, beautiful rock. Or you could try and get all your friends to come and carry it, you know? And it's the same with some difficulty coming up. We don't have to. We don't have to receive it as heavy. It doesn't have to be heavy. And in this sense, this what Ajahn Chah did of creating these monasteries where people would have the friction and the joys of meditating together and living together and learning from that, as well as learning from the jungle. It goes together with that understanding on interdependence and how we are, in a sense, we are context in our world, you know? We're not so separate as me here and the world there. And the world is just like this and I am like this, you know? It's, they are so intermingled, the two. Who I am, it often depends on my context. And how the world is often depends on my attitude to the world. It can be radically different, dependent on the mood you're in. You go out shopping and you can get really irritated with all these really irritating people, you know? And another day you go and it doesn't seem to matter and it seems like the whole world is smiling at you because you're coming with a smile in your heart sometimes and, you know, and all of the possibilities in between. But it's not that we are creating our world just by our attitude. It's a mix. We are context and we are influenced by our world, of course. And in this way of practicing in a community, I think it was he was very ahead of his time, Ajahn Chah. He was very avant-garde in that, realizing what the world needs now in developing the suppleness that comes from the rub with the other humans, with the other beings, that the difficulty. Hey, because a lot of our difficulty is interpersonal, isn't it? Is the relationships with other people. Me and the world, me and the others, me and my family, me and my partner, me and my friends. And that story with the rock, I find it tells it so well of how we don't have to always pick things up in the heaviest way. Especially the attitudes of the world, as in you could say, I live up here in the hills, you know, and sometimes I can go into town. And sometimes, you know, it does feel like everybody's relaxed and friendly and I can talk to strangers and it's great. And somehow that's possible, maybe because of my attitude. And sometimes I get other people's aggression and anxiety and that's my vulnerability feeling it as well. But I don't have to pick up other people's anxieties and aggressions as I don't have to take it all as my problem, as mine to drink in. So So in a way, there's a paradox there. Hey, there's a real paradox of how much our attitude influences others and their response to us. And how also at the same time, we're not responsible for the mood that other people are in, for the difficult time they're having. And often we don't know, especially with strangers in shops and stuff, we don't know what their story is. I think I notice it a little bit more. I have a partner who's very influenceable by the attitudes of the world. And it can really ruin her day sometimes if somebody is a bit rough and a bit. And so I've been really noticing this vulnerability and this thing of you don't have to pick up the big boulders. You don't have to pick up the big rocks. And that doesn't mean that we can't be compassionate to other people, because we don't know their story often. We don't know if their mother just went into hospital, or, you know, their grandfather just died of COVID. Or we don't know other people's stories and why they're being funny and stuff. So I hope I haven't lost you in my journeying here today, from attitude and practice, attitude to how we are on retreat, to our attitude to how we relate and our relationship with the world. I hope it's not too going off into the little jungle paths there. So I would like to add maybe a last bit to this reflection on attitudes. And and this is just bringing in now to this, that like often on retreat, what comes up is we often start to have some clarity around our conditioning, around our programming, our habits, and feel the kind of wheels of that, the compulsivity of that, and it can be a real kindness to yourselves. You know, to know that that's what happens on retreats is often our programming comes up, and to be kind with the programming as we see it, as just programming, as just conditioning. You know, this comes because of how I was brought up, because of my parents or my country or my gender or my whatever, you know. Sometimes when we see it, we have some clarity, really, wow, incisive, incredible clarity into our habits. And then after, you know, 48 hours, that's still happening, the habits. And so we need a lot of patience with the seeing. You know, we see and then we want to get rid of. We want it all to go because we've seen clearly and that's it. Okay, basta, you know. I don't want that conditioning anymore. And it takes a while. It takes a while because things are often subcutaneous, you know, and they go down in different layers. And so we can take one layer of clothing off and then another retreat and we take some more off and then we take some more off and then we come back and we find that we've grown another coat and we need to take that off. And so we need a lot of to have an attitude towards our own clarity of vision that happens from the meditation practice, to be kind with the clarity, not just, it's got to go now. I've seen it, it's got to go. Ciao, you know. And so often people come and they say, I thought that I'd got rid of that, and get so frustrated and irritated. I thought that I'd dealt with that years ago. You know, I thought that I was never going to have another relationship like that. I thought that I'd sorted it all out with my mother. You know, things take time. So shining a light of compassion on where we're at now and what's arising. Being kind with that is vital. It's really, really important to shine a kind light on our shadows, on our non-enlightened caves in there, in our psyche, in our heart, you know. Shine a very kind light there. And this, funnily enough, the shining the kind light actually leads us towards this supple heart, this suppleness in the heart. It goes there. It was kind of the subject, the theme of this retreat was listening to our hearts. Inside listening to the heart. So I see that somehow the time has gone by and I didn't prepare this talk, so I'm surprised. That I think to say. I hope that this has been helpful for you, and that anything that isn't helpful now, or that if it's not helpful and you're really sure about it, just let it go. Just let it go. And otherwise, it will be helpful later. If it's difficult to understand or I haven't been clear in some way, it might come. Maybe I'll say something later and then he'll go, oh yeah, that's what he was talking about. And thank you for listening and for being here. I can feel the receptivity through the screen, actually, which is, it's interesting. Thank you. So does anybody have any questions or anything to share on this theme or on another theme? You're most welcome to share, to just unmute and say something if you please. Shall I read this poem again? Yeah? So every morning I sit, I kneel, waiting, making friends with the habit of listening, hoping that I'm being listened to. I say hello to my chaos, my unmade decisions, my unmade bed, my desire and my trouble. I recognize and greet my burdens, my controlled and uncontrollable stories, my unfolding story, my unloved body, my own love, my own body. I greet the things I think will happen, and I say hello to everything I do not know about the day. I greet my own small world, and I hope that I can meet the bigger world that day. I greet my story during the day and hope that I can forget my story during the day, and that I can hear some stories and greet some surprising stories during the long day ahead. I greet God, and I greet the God who is more God than the God I greet. Hello to you all, I say, as the sun rises above the chimneys of northern Belfast. Hello. So I love his attitude to his spiritual practice. Greeting the unmade bed in the stories and the unknown stories and the stories to come and the stories he'll hear. Thank you. So we'll see each other later at 8:15 for some chanting and a bit of a meditation. And I hope you have a good rest of afternoon, in a cup of tea, maybe some walking meditation, whatever it is for you.